Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Finding the right news podcast can feel like dating. It seems promising until you start listening.
When you hit play on Post Reports, you'll get fascinating conversations and sometimes a little fun too. I'm Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Azadi. Martine and I are the hosts of Post Reports. The show comes out every weekday from the Washington Post.
You can follow and listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. It'll be a match, I promise.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Thinking Sideways is not brought to you by Unicorns on Unicycles. Instead, it's supported by the generous donations of our listeners on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/thinkingsideways to learn more. And thanks.
Thinking Sideways.
I don't understand.
Does not compute.
You never know.
It's the vicious state of the formulated
mind. What?
Stories of things we simply don't know the answer to.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Thinking Sideways, the podcast. I'm Devin, joined as always by
Steve,
Joe,
and somebody else apparently.
Yeah. Okay,
and Joe. Words out all the
and
time.
Joe. Oh, yeah, that's true.
He I does. Do.
Today we're going to talk about a mystery.
Oh, really?
A pretty big mystery. Actually, kind of one that's touted as one of the biggest unsolved mysteries.
This is one of those ones that you'll hear referred to on the lists on the internet of like locked room mysteries, mm-hmm. kind of style, where it's the perfect mystery.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It's always ranked up in there.
It is. Oh, and I have to say, it's a puzzler for sure. But for as big a mystery it is, there's not,
it's not that big of a mystery. It's not that big.
Yeah.
Well, you know, but still, people have been chewing over it for a long time. A lot of
Absolutely.
Famous people, like Raymond Chandler, for example, says it's his favorite mystery of all time. Or said it was. He's dead. But
he might still say.
Yeah, he's
saved in heaven. We haven't tackled that mystery yet.
Yeah. Yeah. He's in heaven. He knows the answer now.
Yeah.
We'll have to have a seance and find out.
Yeah. Okay, so, you guys ready?
Yeah.
Indeed.
Okay. In the evening of Monday, January 20th of 1931, sometime between 6:45 and 8:45 p.m., Julia Wallace was beaten to death, brutally. Her husband, William Herbert Wallace, seemed a really likely suspect and was arrested, tried, and convicted. So what's the mystery? Well, it turns out the evidence was really, really lacking in the case against Mr. Wallace.
Pretty hugely, I would say.
So shoddy, in fact, that the Criminal Court of Appeals officially pardoned him and declared he was innocent and totally said, nope, he's not guilty at all. He's free to go. And nobody knows who did this crime.
No.
Nobody knows who murdered Julia Wallace.
There's a few suspects. But yeah, it's interesting when he was tried. I think his demeanor kind of did him in. He was kind of
cold.
This
is another one of those Bramber cases.
Like Bramber, Jeremy Bramber. Yeah.
Yep.
And he was apparently not liked by the jury because the judge, when he was instructing the jury, all but told them they had to let him off.
Find him off, yeah.
And they convicted him anyway.
Because the evidence was just so weak.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that.
Oh, yeah.
The evidence was actually kind of non-existent, really.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, so.
So let's tell the story.
Let's solve the mystery.
Well, let's tell the story first.
Okay.
Okay. And I want to just introduce you to the two main characters, I guess. The first character would be one Mrs. Wallace. Her maiden name was Dennis. She was Julia Dennis originally. She married Mr. Wallace in March of 1914. She was significantly older than Mr. Wallace. I think it was 17 years, according to the dates I could find on the wiki.
Yeah. There's a lot of contention over that, because for a long time, people said that they were around the same age.
Yeah, everybody thought that they were definitely contemporaries. And then I think somebody was able to find her original birth certificate.
I think it was in the last decade or two.
Yeah, I think so too, which said that she was 17 years older than him. So she was 53 when they were married and he was 36.
Uh-huh.
Which is quite it's a reversal of roles for the time.
Yeah, but it's also that's still a big age gap.
Oh, yeah, but it used to be the old man would marry the younger woman. Yeah.
Especially back in those days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Some people kind of point to that as maybe something that had to do with the murder.
Well, he found out how old she was. And
I think that's I think it's really silly, but I've seen that tossed around. So just to go ahead and throw that out.
Actually, I think that her age might have had, if he did indeed kill her age might have had something to do with it. You want to hear about it now?
No.
No? Okay.
I don't. No.
Okay.
We can talk about that later.
All right.
Julia was originally the daughter of a, quote, ruined alcoholic farmer, unquote. And there's really, like, nothing about her except for that she played the piano quite well. I think she was an accomplished pianist is how they describe her.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't even have her own Wikipedia page despite being the victim of this crime.
Loser.
No, I mean, it's interesting. I think there's a lot to be said about a victim. I think that the victim really informs the crime a lot of times.
Very true.
So I am sad that there's not more information about her out there because I think it just seems like we would be able to know more about the crime maybe or
well, everybody something. Focused on her husband. And
oh, yeah.
So details of her were just left behind. And that may be why we won't ever be able to solve it because there may be things about her that we just don't have access to anymore.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I was able to find some quotes from some people about her.
She was described as meek and kind of uninteresting.
Meek. Yeah, there was one person who was looking in on them for about 3 weeks in 1923. Mm-hmm. Her name was Florence Mary Wilson. And William Wallace had a bout of pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
And so this person was basically, you know, looking after them.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that she thought Julia was a poor housekeeper who basically laid around and did nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she had no enthusiasm for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she didn't really think that they were a happy couple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so there's a little bit of insight. Of course, you know, that's a small window. It doesn't necessarily mean she was always that way.
Yeah.
But there were other people also who said that they didn't really think it was a happy marriage.
Yeah. It's interesting. People didn't seem to think it was a happy marriage, but they lived in this kind of townhouse, row house situation that's pretty common in London, Liverpool, I guess. But they shared walls with their next door neighbors, and their neighbors said they never heard them raise voices or really talking at all, which may have been a sign, I guess, that they didn't talk that much. But
could be they had their own thing.
Yeah, but
well,
they
yeah,
didn't
there's definitely
fight loudly. At least.
There's two different ways to go about hating each other that we've seen in it's people with their relationship. They either yell at each other or they say nothing.
Yeah.
And so it may be that's why nobody heard anything.
Yeah.
So they just did their own thing and ignored each other.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so let's talk
probably
a little bit about Wallace. We're going to refer to him as Wallace through the rest of this thing because apparently he's the only one that really matters. And then we'll call Julia Wallace Julia.
Okay.
Wallace was born in 1878. And he left school at 14 when he started to train to be a draper's assistant. He got a job with the company that outfitted Her Majesty's Armed Forces and the Colonial Indian and Foreign Services in Manchester. He spent 5 years with the company, then transferred to Calcutta, India, then Shanghai 2 years after that with the same company. His youngest brother lived in Shanghai, so there was a familial connection. He had a bum kidney, So he had to return to England in 1907.
He didn't want to have it cut out in Shanghai?
Yeah, for some reason.
Wanted to have it done in England instead?
Yeah, yeah, he decided to come back to England. So he did actually have the operation. He had it cut out. And then there's about a four-year gap in between there until he became an election agent in 1911, where he met Julia. And then they got married in 1914, as we said. And then they moved to Liverpool in 1915 because he had lost his job. And
yeah, it was because it was, didn't he lose his job because the position of elections was just basically totally eliminated? Isn't that the reason?
I think it was,
It was some crown rule that eliminated all of the work that he was doing.
Yeah, it was totally eliminated. So he lost his job and he called his dad and was like, "Dad, I need a job." And his father helped him get a job with the Prudential Assurance Company as a collections agent. And the Prudential is an insurance, life insurance company, by and large. And they're based in Liverpool. So, yeah, the couple is described as meek. Wallace had an unusually curious brain for the time, I gather. In that, it wasn't typical for a person, particularly a man, but a person to take interest in kind of a wide variety of topics. But Wallace did. He supplemented his time and income by lecturing in chemistry. He had an interest in botany. He was a violinist. He was an amateur electrician. He had a lab, lab.
He played with electricity at home?
Yeah, at home. And he loved chess. And he was, in fact, a member of the Liverpool Central Chess Club, not to be confused with the Liverpool Chess Club or the Central Chess Club, because those are two other things.
Oh, okay.
And that's a very serious offense to be taken, apparently.
Oh, really?
In my research, I found.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Is this chess club still in existence? And do they still meet at the same place?
No. The Central Chess Club is still a thing, I think. But
this particular one, I'm pretty sure, was eventually disbanded.
Yeah. It was pretty small when Wallace was going to it. They weren't very good chess players, and it was a small chess club. And then this whole thing happened, and
it was kind of a third-rank club.
So actually, our story kind of begins at a meeting of this club. So we want to just transition into that.
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome.
Let's swing into it.
Cool. So January 19th, 1931, Wallace was meant to be competing in a chess championship over a number of months. And so this was one match that he was supposed to be competing in. His game was scheduled to start at 7:45 p.m. And at 7:20 p.m., I believe, the chess club received a phone call from a R.M.
Qualtrough. Is it Qualtrough or Qualtrough?
I think it's Qualtrough.
Yeah.
He was looking for Wallace, and he left a message with the club captain, whose name was Samuel Beatty. The message was that Mr. Wallace was requested to call upon Mr. Qualtrough. That's how he's going to say from now on.
Qualtrough. Yeah.
The next evening at about 7:30 p.m. at 25 Menlove Gardens East, regarding an insurance issue, because one of Wallace's jobs was to sell insurance as well as collect insurance dues and things like that. And so it seemed that this gentleman had some insurance business to carry out.
I think that's one thing. It took me a while to figure out, and a lot of people aren't familiar with this now, but in those days, you had to walk around and collect payment from your customers.
Yeah.
So, and that's one of the big things he did, is he walked around town all day
and paid,
picking up money.
Yeah, got money from people.
Probably kept him in good shape.
Probably.
Yeah.
So Mr. Wallace obviously wasn't there at the time, and the caller did ask Beatty, is Mr. Wallace expected to be there tonight? And he said, oh, I don't know if I can expect him or not, because it turns out he was fairly delinquent in his attendance.
Yeah, he only showed up a couple of times a month, I hear.
I thought it was, they said once a fortnight, so once every 2 weeks, 14 days-ish. So he didn't know, Beatty didn't know if Wallace was going to show up or not. He said if he was going to be there, he'd be there soon, and he'd relay the message. Wallace said that he had never heard of Qualtrough, and he also hadn't heard of Menlove Gardens East. And a few other members of the chess club discussed it. And I think he said, well, I've got a Scotch tongue in my brain or in my head or something like that.
Weirdest phrase.
It was a very odd phrase, meaning that he would find it. They all figured it was just off Menlove Avenue somewhere, and that'd be that.
It must exist.
Yeah.
And that's the way it was, because I did some reading on this, because I didn't understand why this guy would just go trooping across town, not knowing where he was going. That would freak me out. But it just turns out, I know this has got to be off of that, so I'm just going to walk down it until I find it.
Yeah, and one of the guys at the club said, well, I know Men Love Gardens North. Or something, so I think they just all thought, well, it must be there somewhere.
Yeah, there's a north, south, and a west, so yeah. Why not an east?
Yeah. So despite not knowing really anything about this, it just being kind of a blind call, Wallace decides to keep the appointment. So the next day on the 20th, he arrives home from work around 6 p.m. And then sometime between 6:30 and 6:45, the milk boy stopped to pick up his money, which he got from Julia. He said, I got it from Julia. There's been some speculation that it was Wallace in drag, but I'm sure it wasn't. It was definitely Julia. And then I don't know how the milk boy would have known what time it was.
He said he saw the time on a church clock.
And there was
either right before or right after.
And there was one.
Yeah, there's a church a few blocks away that's got three clocks on its sonnet.
So he would have known.
Yeah.
So we can presume his time is about correct?
Yeah, I don't know if anybody checked, if the police checked the church to see if the clocks were correct.
Yeah, I don't know.
That would have been something to check on.
Turns out they were running on daylight savings.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
that would be too bad.
The Liverpool police in this case, the locals called them the Jiggery Pokey Brigade.
Yeah, they're not very good.
Or Jiggery Pokery Brigade.
They didn't have the best reputation.
Yeah.
I think the milk boy saw Wallace there too, I'm not sure. But I got on Google Maps, I pulled a Joe. Got on Google Maps and mapped directions from the Wallace's rented flat to 25 Men Love Gardens West, because that's an actual address. And on today's transit, it would take no less than 37 minutes. And according to the train schedules at the time, which I actually looked up, he would have had to been on the tram at 6:49 p.m. for the whole timeline to make sense. And it's verified that he's coming off of that tram at exactly the right time. So we can assume, I think, pretty reasonably, that he was definitely on the tram at 6:49 p.m. that night.
Yeah. And
based on the conversations that directly followed that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And how far was the tram stop from his house?
Not very far, but...
Okay.
It was a bit of a walk. But
maybe 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Not anything...
Hang on. So I remember something about in their awesome investigation, the police having a young, fit officer play the part of Wallace. And I remember there was discussions of him running. And so I was under the impression that meant that he was running from the house to the tram stop, which made me think the tram stop was farther away.
Oh, the 2 mile running thing?
Yeah, 2 miles. Yeah, okay. Sounds right.
And that he ran to get there at 7:06 to make this transfer.
I don't remember
the
time.
Okay, so the 2 miles thing is that he made a transfer to a different tram and had an interaction with the conductor of that tram.
Right.
And that transfer spot was 2 miles away.
Oh,
so I presume that they were trying to see if anybody fit could run that 2 miles in the allotted time that they would have needed.
And bypass the first tram.
And bypass that first tram.
Even though Wallace was 51, bad kidney, think he had a bad heart.
He had meningitis recently.
Yeah.
I think he was a heavy smoker too, wasn't he?
I think so.
So actually, it's absurd to assume that he could have kept that pace.
Nobody would have noticed this guy running, breakneck pace.
Right, or that the conversation he would have had with the conductor wouldn't have said, oh, and he was super breathless.
And by the way, sweating.
Yeah.
Sweating a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, the police actually didn't just do one detective running. They sent out a half a dozen teams at various times to try different
just
theories
to see.
And stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is probably the most thorough job they did on any part of the
investigation. I know.
But no, I think that's what you're talking about. The two
it's
miles that
be.
You're thinking of. I think that tram stop, and I'm sorry to anybody who's going to call us out on that. I don't actually know, but I think it was a 5 minute walk or something.
Okay.
Like
so
that
it wasn't too far
house.
Away.
It wasn't that far. Yeah. Because the 2 miles that you are talking about is the transfer he made.
Was two miles away from his home. Okay.
From one tram to the other. There's streetcars, right? You guys know what trams are.
Yeah.
And that was at 7:06 p.m., which, was right on schedule with him being on the tram right before at the 6:49 mark. And he had a conversation with the conductor, and he asked him directions to Men Love Gardens East and was told to transfer trams again at Penny Lane. And he spent most of that 10-minute ride pestering the driver to not forget to call out Penny Lane. And a lot of people think that's suspicious. I think it's...
It's possible.
I think it's just like a nerve... I've done stuff like that before, not like the entire time, because I've then gotten really awkward and thought like, oh, I'm annoying this person. But if I don't know where I'm going, I get really anxious. And especially if I were trying to make a meeting and I really didn't know where I was going and was maybe running a little late by my own sense, I definitely can see the like, okay, but don't forget to call, like, don't forget to do it. Have we missed it? I really don't know where I am right now.
It's not
what's
like
going
everything
on.
Was lit up and easy to see.
Yeah, yeah. It's January. It's, you know, it's
1931.
We're December and it's dark at, you know, 4 o'clock right now. So it's dark out. And also, you know, you can't pull your map or phone out of your back pocket. You have no idea what's going on.
Wasn't as easy back in those days.
Yeah. So I don't think it's as suspicious as most people think, but some people do think it's really suspicious.
Yeah, a lot of people feel that he tried to call people's attention to himself, repeatedly.
There's a lot of that in this story, though. Yeah. But there's a lot of, I got to admit, I'll just tell you right now, there's several things that I'm just going to point out with one word, which is claim.
Yeah.
They make a lot of claims about certain things that he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is one of them.
Yeah.
So the conductor, of course, did not forget to call
Penny. He
wanted
him to get off the stupid train.
Yeah, he was like, oh my God, get off now. He's like, this is your stop, get off. And Wallace made the connection, no problem. He got on the next tram and he asked the conductor promptly, hey, where do I get off for Men Love Gardens East? The conductor said, you get off at Men Love Avenue and walk. And probably was told to just saw it off and look for it.
Yeah,
would be my guess.
Quit bothering me.
Yeah, just get off here. And it was only like a 600-foot ride or something like that.
Yeah, it was stupid.
It was
short.
Stupid short. But I think all the conductors were just like, "You do this. I don't know. You just do this thing." But he did. He got off at the avenue and started to search for Men Love Gardens East. There was a Men Love Gardens North, South, and West, but not East.
What
apparently, he was really determined, so he asked a number of passersby, you know, where is this street? None of them had ever heard of Men Love Gardens East. He went to 25 Men Love Gardens West to see if they knew anything about it. They said, no, we've never heard of anybody, and we didn't make a call. Go away. Wallace did what you're meant to do and found a local beat cop next. And, okay, people, there's the claim. And I think the cop said this, so I'm willing to say that this happened. But instead of just saying, oh, I'm looking for this address, he apparently regaled the cop with the entire story of the call and then the train ride and then the difficulty he's been asking people all the time. And, oh, do you know where this address is? Finally, you know, at the end of that. And the cop said, no, that place doesn't exist.
I got the feeling through some of the things that he's said and done before everything happened and then... As it was going on, he was just kind of an awkward guy. He was just one of those ones
who
couldn't cut to the chase.
And anxious and didn't really know how to interact with people. That was my sense of him. Yeah, definitely. So he was not satisfied with the copper saying, no, that's not a thing. But he did ask the cop what time it was. And he asked it in kind of a strange way, apparently. And he said, it's not 8 o'clock yet, is it? And the cop said, no. So he checked the time and he said, no, it's 7:45. And Wallace looked at his watch and he said, oh yeah, it's 7:45. And again, people think that's suspicious, which I don't think so, but okay, fine, whatever. He was still not satisfied. So he walked over to a local newsstand and they had directories in the newsstand apparently. So he looked through the directory, still the address didn't exist. So finally, he's had enough at this point. He would have been really late. Or, as some people claim, he'd made enough stink to have a good alibi.
Well, and he also made a stink with the person at the...
At the newsstand.
At the newsstand.
Yeah, again,
it wasn't a stink, though, right? It was this address is?
He made enough of an impression.
A distinct interaction. And again, you know, he asked her, he looked up and he said, do you know what I'm looking for? And she said, no. And he told her the address and she said, no, that doesn't exist. And he said, okay, fine, I'm gonna go home then, fine. And he got home. I guess it seems like he searched for about 45 minutes all told. You know, he got off the tram at 7:15.
Searched till 8.
Left probably about 8. Yeah. Got home, I guess around, you know, I think that that trip takes about 45 minutes. I think my math is good. It's a half an hour, maybe?
About a half an hour. But then again, he's got to wait for
a tram.
It's not as if the stupid thing just is there when you're there.
Right. I mean, maybe it is, but...
Rarely.
Yeah.
But he basically, long story short, he got home about 8:45, right?
8:30 or 8:45. 8:30 is probably the earliest he could have gotten home, reasonably.
Uh-huh.
8:45 is probably when he got home. But again, the next time he's seen is 8:45. He's standing outside of his back door, and his neighbors, the Johnstons, are just leaving. They encounter him in the back alleyway, and he looks, God, what's the quote?
Worried and confused.
Worried and confused, thank you. He looks worried and confused, and they say, okay, Mr. Wallace, what's up? And he says, well, my keys aren't working. My key in the front or the back door, they're not working. And they said, well, we have a spare key to your house. Do you want us to try our key? And he said, oh, blah, blah, blah. I've never heard what he said, so I just assume he just kind of mumbled. And then he tried his back door key again, and miraculously it opened.
This time it worked, yeah.
And they waited around, because they were good neighbors. They thought, okay, he seems confused and worried and weird, and we'll just wait till he gives us the all clear. So they kind of waited around, and he went upstairs, and he lit the gas in the parlor, and then he came back down and just very calmly said, come and see, she's been killed.
Strange.
I think he was in shock. I think he was in shock. Because I would be in shock if I walked into this.
Oh,
this scene,
absolutely. But
for sure.
Can we stop for a second and talk about the door?
Yeah.
So he tried, if I understood correctly, and I just want to make sure I understand this, he tried the front door and his key wouldn't work, or the door wouldn't unlock. And then he went to the back door and he couldn't get it to unlock with his key. And then he tried it again in front of the Johnstones, and that's when it opened.
Yes,
correct.
The back door opened.
The back door.
Yeah. Okay, so apparently the deadbolt or the latch had been shut on the inside.
Is that what it was? Because I was thinking, well, maybe there was somebody, like, was the front door unlocked when they went to look at it later? Because it makes me wonder. Hey, you can't maybe see in, and so he's trying his key, and somebody's holding the lock?
No, but you know what I just thought of is maybe the front door was unlocked when he arrived, and he accidentally locked it. It seems unlikely, but I guess...
It seems like a drunk move, I just got home and am peeved kind of move.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because, if he actually was telling the truth, and say the bolt had been shot from the inside on both the front and the rear, then he comes home to... If he is totally telling the truth, then he wasn't just confused and not using his key correctly. That must mean the murderer was inside.
Exactly where I was going.
Yeah, so he's busy rattling the front door, and then the murderer like boogies out the back door, and of course he can't shoot the bolt this time around.
Right.
He pulls the door shut behind him and sneaks off down the alley.
Oh, that he would have tried the back door first,
mm-hmm.
and that didn't work, so he tried the front door. And that didn't work, so he came back around.
Uh-huh.
At which point they
encountered him kind of walking back to try the back door again. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you can go.
The Johnstones?
Yeah.
Yes.
And that he said, my key's not working, and they said, okay, and he tried it again, and the bolt wasn't locked? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Huh.
So the door was locked, but the bolt had not been shot from the inside.
Interesting.
Because that's the only way this whole I can't get my key to work thing mm-hmm. makes sense to me, is
yeah,
if somebody else was inside, you know, manually operating a lock that he mm-hmm. couldn't have access to.
That's true.
Yeah,
yeah, that's not a bad point. Although that would mean the murderer had a key to the house.
Not necessarily, because you don't use a key to lock your door from the inside.
No, but I guess he could have left the door unlocked, and that Mr. Wallace just out of habit tried to unlock it, and it worked.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what you're saying? Yeah, okay, so that's fair. That's good. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, so who knows?
There's not a scrap of evidence to support that, but...
Oh, I know.
Well, that's the refrain of this entire case, though. Is
not
there's
a
not
scrap
a scrap
of
evidence to support that, but we're going to say it anyway. So what did Mr. Wallace find? And I guess the Johnstones, Johnstones?
I think it's the Johnstones, but...
Johnstones.
Either way, they saw something they could never unsee.
Yeah. It was a really gruesome scene in the parlor. Julia had... her head had been bashed in 11 times. Her brain was exposed, and the blood splatter in some places was 7 feet up on the walls.
Uh-huh.
Which is pretty high.
What happens when you beat somebody to death with a poker?
Definitely would, yeah. And the Johnstons, As I mentioned, the walls were thin in between, and I think the parlor wall, they shared a wall, and they had been home all night, and they said they hadn't heard anything, which is kind of weird. Well, like, one would assume that you would at least scream a little the first time that you got hit.
Not if that first one catches you unawares and rattles your little brain.
Yeah, that's true.
That's entirely possible.
Followed by several swift hits, you're out. You're
done.
Although there is one other explanation for them not hearing anything, and that is that they did it.
And it's possible.
There's actually, I found somebody out there that claims that the Johnsons
did it. We'll talk about
it.
That in theories, because it's actually not the worst theory out there.
Yeah.
So yeah, as we were talking about, we kind of, I guess, shot our load a little early. The big whole mystery on this thing is that all of the windows and doors were locked, ostensibly, when Mr. Wallace arrived. So it's one of those locked room mysteries where you're just like, how did the murderer get out?
Well, yep. they weren't deadbolted though, were they?
I don't know.
The thing is that it never says how they were locked.
Yeah, I mean, because you can always pull a door shut behind you.
Yeah, although it's 1931, so I don't know.
I don't know what kind of keys they had.
Yeah, I don't think they were. I think they were mostly deadbolt locks at that point.
Well, I know. Okay, my experience in Britain with locks has never been good because I get locked out all the time when I'm over there because they don't believe in door handles. It's all keys
and
they auto lock behind you, which is why I'm wondering if, like Joe said, they just auto locked automatically. Yeah. That was the standard way to do it.
Yeah, but I guess...
I don't know.
I guess the frustrating thing in that case then, right, is that like... then why is that such a big mystery? Like, if it's so ubiquitous in this area that doors would just lock behind you, why is everybody saying, and the doors were locked? Like, okay, cool. Then the murderer left out the door.
Why are there so many claims about the things this guy could do?
Yeah.
Like, that's right up there with
true.
It.
That's true, yeah. That's
Although,
true.
If it was the old-fashioned kind, like the church key kind, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If it was one of those, in those days, a lot of the times people would leave their key in the lock on the inside, and that's a way to block somebody from the outside picking your lock, and so your key is blocking it, and that was very common in those days. So there might have just been a key in one of the front of the rear doors,
just there.
He just takes the key out, steps outside, pulls it shut, and takes the key and locks the door. And
calmly that's walks true. Away.
And walks away all covered with gore.
Yeah, well, yeah, super covered in blood. Because that's the thing, is that like this person would have been just
coated in blood.
There wasn't really anything missing. Mr. Wallace said that there were a couple pounds maybe missing, and then the only other thing that was missing were two fireplace instruments, a poker, and a metal bar. I don't know what the metal bar
I could
was.
Never determine what the bar was, but it finally showed up.
It finally did show up a long time after.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the poker never did show up, so.
Yeah, the poker didn't show up.
Just walked away.
And actually, the bar showed up with no blood on it.
Yeah.
Like 80 years later.
Yeah, it was
something.
Like in the back of the fireplace.
Yeah, it had fallen through a hole in the bottom or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's the Macintosh, the raincoat.
Oh, yeah, and then there was a partially burned Macintosh or a raincoat underneath her body.
It was supposedly his.
It was his. There was no supposedly
about it.
Oh,
it was his?
It definitely was his, but that doesn't mean that he was, involved, really.
Oh, yeah. No,
because it would have been by the door, so.
Okay, see, that's funny, because I had heard contention that it might not have been his.
Mm.
Like, it may have been somebody else's, and they took his on the way out, say.
Oh, I guess that's fair. It matched his.
I thought it was his.
I thought it was his, too, but I'm
reading a lot between the lines.
The investigation into this is so poor that I guess I can't say definitively that it was his. It looked like his. That's all I can say.
Got it. Yeah.
They also didn't do any evidence or anything like that.
Because it had been partially burned.
It had been partially burned, yeah. So.
Can I ask? Oh, I'm sorry. I know I do this to you all the time, but I have a question. Crime scene photo.
Yeah.
I swear I've seen it, but I also thought it was a recreation.
Yeah, so I've seen a lot of pictures that look like they might be crime scene photos. I think they're all reenactments.
Recreations. That's
because
I don't,
because there's not enough blood in any of them.
Thank you. Okay.
Well, I saw a couple of photos, and I think they were the real thing.
They were taken
either by police or by reporters on the night of.
Huh.
Yeah.
I saw those too, and I just didn't think that there was enough blood.
Yeah,
So I don't know.
It's kind of hard to tell. They're kind of murky pictures.
They're really, really murky.
Yeah. I saw these in a book. John Gannon wrote a book called "The Killing of Julia Wallace."
He did. We're going to talk about.
Have you seen that? Yeah. Have you seen the book? He's got a lot of pictures in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't know. I can't authenticate what the pictures, if they were real or not. Just again, because it doesn't seem like it looks like the crime scene was described to have been, but. It's also possible that the description of the crime scene is inaccurate.
Well, I was going to say, is that's the thing, is that I saw something that talked about when Julia was struck and she fell, I saw something, I swear, that said that the reason that the Macintosh had caught on fire was that she had fallen forward into the fireplace.
No, that he had fallen forward into the fire. The person wearing the Macintosh had fallen forward into the fireplace and it had partially caught fire.
Oh, so they're saying... This doesn't make any freaking sense. Wait.
Yeah, it really doesn't.
And that it was that they put the fire out and then pushed it under her body.
No. Oh, so killer wearing said Macintosh mm-hmm. catches on fire, mm-hmm. stops, drops, and rolls, mm-hmm. and then rolls her up in it.
Or rolls, shoves it under.
Rolls it underneath her.
Why would somebody do that, though?
I don't know.
It doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense.
It's tidy.
I think it makes more sense that that she died on it.
Yeah. It's entirely, one theory about the Macintosh is that it was indeed Wallace's Macintosh. Mm-hmm. He hadn't taken it with him. Mm-hmm. And he had it probably hanging on a hook by the front door.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody called on her for whatever reason, rang the bell, and mm-hmm. she put that on against the cold or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or maybe she
I
was,
have seen that
right,
too.
Right, that was another theory.
Yeah, and that she was actually wearing it. And mm-hmm. not necessarily with her arms in the sleeves, just draped over her shoulders. Maybe... who knows? Maybe she was in her pajamas and she was feeling modest or mm-hmm. for some reason or, whatever reason. Probably the cold.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's probably what it was.
I agree, but...
The fireplace was on,
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could say, somebody came over for whatever reason to murder her, obviously. But it would have been somebody she knew.
Yeah, and let's save this.
You want to save that?
Yeah, I want to save this.
All right, let's talk about that a little later then.
So, despite having a pretty solid alibi, created or not, and a really severe lack of forensic evidence, the cops arrested Wallace, as we said, and charged
Several
him
days
with
later.
Murder. It was a couple days later. Yeah.
As we
talked about a little bit, too, this case, it's another case of the jury just kind of not liking the guy.
Yeah, the public, they hated him.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. He was definitely condemned in public for the rest of his life. Really.
Oh, yeah, he constantly got hate mail,
death threats
and stuff.
Yeah. He took the witness stand against, or in his defense, I guess. Not against himself.
but he did kind of work against himself.
Yeah, and he appeared detached and cold. And the jury did convict him. The trial lasted 4 days, and the jury deliberated for less than an hour. And he was sentenced to hang for the crime. But then in March of 1931, the Court of Appeals did overturn the ruling. They just said there just wasn't enough evidence to have convicted Wallace. And so he was innocent. He obviously found it hard to return to normal life in Liverpool. So he moved to the country, and then he died in 1933, just 2 years later, of a kidney issue.
Well, no, he didn't move to the country right away, because I know he took a non-public-facing job with mm-hmm. the insurance company for a while.
No, he tried to return. He moved, I think he lived in Liverpool for 6 months or something.
Okay,
And then
sounds
he moved
right.
to the country.
Okay.
Yeah, he probably...
But he was pretty sick, too.
Yeah, he was getting progressively worse.
Yeah, he was worse.
Neither one of those two was really in great health.
No.
Okay, so he was 51 at the time of the murder.
Yeah.
17-year age difference means his wife would have been 68.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking about, they both would have been a rather...
That's an older...
Rather slow pair. Yeah. And I can see her age at that time of being 68 in the 30s
mm-hmm.
is, to me, kind of the equivalent of being 90 today.
Yeah. Kind of is, yeah.
I mean, just because of the way that you live and the harsh lifestyle. So mm-hmm. I can see why she may have been considered kind of lackluster and just old and mm-hmm. tired and just couldn't take it anymore.
Well, I think that he didn't really have much in the way of motive, except maybe he was just sick of her. Yeah, but the other thing about it was I was going to mention her age as a motivation for him. Like you said, that would have been back in those days the equivalent of 85 or 90 years old. And he's starting to look at this and thinking, I don't want to spend the rest of my life changing her diapers. you know, I'm going to put her out to pasture. That's kind of the way he looked at it. That would be a motivation,
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe he was just sick of her.
Yeah, that's also possible.
But
there's
still...
some quote, actually. The quote, I think, was, is that you need no more motivation than being married.
Yeah. From her side.
Yeah. Which I think is probably fair, I say, to a newlywed Steve.
Yes, I did add matricide to my list of words.
Yeah,
that I'm now going to start using around the house.
Yeah,
so that it's not actually a threat.
Oh yeah, she'll appreciate it.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so we can jump into theories, but I just want to mention two or three things first. One big, really big thing is that the police unit that came to investigate the murder was really, 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 really subpar.
Yeah.
To say the least.
Well, at the Liverpool police, I'm sure they're highly professional today, but back
in those
days...
actually, I think it was in 1919, there was a huge strike and they lost more than half of their police force.
It was a huge amount.
Yeah. And so, you know, I guess within 10 years, essentially, they had tried to replace everybody and it was not going very well.
I believe the term I saw for the staff was underqualified.
Yeah. But okay, so the really... fine, whatever, they were unqualified. The biggest blow to this case that happened was their forensic expert, I guess they called him.
Yeah, use air quotes around the word expert.
His name was John McFall, and he operated under the pretense that his instinct was enough. He didn't take notes. He didn't run tests. He observed Julia's body and decided, based just on the rigor of her body, that she had to have been killed at 6 p.m., give or take an hour.
He actually had originally said she died somewhere around 8 o'clock or so, and then wound back the clock on that to match up when they charged Wallace.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a little bit
of... So that's hinky step number one.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only test that was, and that was the only test that was done on her at the
time.
Yeah,
he didn't
do body temperature.
They didn't take any
blood samples. They didn't collect any forensic evidence. They didn't try and fingerprint or anything like that. They did, I guess, somehow, and I don't know how, but I guess they were able to determine that nobody had cleaned themselves up at the house. There wasn't evidence that somebody took a shower. To clean
the drains were dry.
Off. The drains were dry. Yeah.
Yeah.
So okay, that was good. At least they did that. So we know that whoever killed her would have been really, really bloody and would have had to have probably left the house pretty bloody.
And that fact alone completely to me blew their theory of what he did out of the water.
Sure did.
Because you're saying, hey, we've proved that nobody took a shower or used water in this house in hours and hours. But this guy, he was buck naked and he killed his wife. Or my favorite is he was buck naked
in
the Macintosh.
Yeah, the police actually questioned him quite extensively about the practice around his house of... They totally made this up, but they decided that he and he played the violin and Julia played the piano. They had these music nights. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, yeah, you like to do that naked wearing just your Macintosh, don't you? And he said, no, what? And they said, yeah, that's how you play the violin when she's playing the piano. You're just wearing your raincoat. And he said, no, what are you talking about? And they said, no, you like hanging out like that. So we're just going to go ahead and enter that as a matter of fact.
Uh-huh.
You would like hang out with that. So obviously you killed her like that. So that's the kind of detective work that was happening around this case.
I know.
I forgot about that.
So I think that does. It blows a pretty big hole, especially because the timeline just doesn't match up, right? You know, we know based on the timeline that she was seen alive at about 6:45. He left.
6:30
At the earliest, he had to have left the house at the latest, I would say, at 6:49, but probably at 6:45-ish. He would have had to left the house to be on the tram to get there in time. There's no way that he ran it. No way he ran those 2 miles.
Yeah.
And
when he got home, he didn't have any blood on him at all.
Yeah. Well, he was clean as a whistle. None of his clothes had blood on it. He didn't have blood on it. You know, there was no blood anywhere. And then the earliest he could have come back really is 8. So there could have been a 45-minute gap there. But I think he probably was there more like 8:30 based on when people were seeing him around that.
He couldn't have got back that early because he had the interaction with the policeman at 7:45,
right? So the earliest he could have been back really is like 8:30.
Yeah.
So there's 15 minutes there. So really you got 15 minutes on either end to commit a brutal murder for, you know, probably provoked reasons, then totally clean up. That's insane to me. That's crazy to me.
Yeah, the only
and
way...
clean up outside of the house somewhere.
Yeah, because he couldn't do it. Yeah,
because he couldn't have done it in the house.
Yeah, and right? So
the
only
way
the
back garden is for.
Yeah, but the only way they were able to get a conviction here it was by impeaching the testimony of the milk boy, whose name was Alan Close.
Yeah.
I don't know that he was not. I thought he was credible. Of course, I never saw or met the guy or heard him actually speak. But
there's no reason to not believe. So anyway, that's a big thing. Right? The medical examiner
very important
was
to keep
bad.
In mind.
Yeah.
And the drains were all dry. Yeah. So you guys want to talk about theories? Because there are only two.
Is there?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean,
there's a few other theories
there's
out
there. There's two big ones.
There's two main theories.
And then there's like some sub theories.
Well, we'll
because
we're
really,
gonna explore them.
Well, really, either Mr. Wallace killed his wife or he didn't.
Pretty
and
much.
The quote you hear around this is either Mr. Wallace killed his wife or he didn't. And if he didn't, then we have the perfect crime. I disagree, but hey.
Well, yeah, if he did it, it was the perfect crime. If he didn't do it, it wasn't really the perfect crime.
Right.
That's how, you know, lots of people get killed and bludgeoned to death and nobody ever gets caught. So.
Yeah. So let's talk about he totally did it first.
All right.
As repeated over and over again, as we just talked about, there's no more motive needed to kill your spouse than being married to them.
Yeah.
It sounds like their marriage wasn't particularly happy. It didn't sound like it was horrendously unhappy, though. It just sounded kind of...
blasé.
Yeah. Blah. And he wasn't like an adventure seeker. You know, it's not like he was saying, oh, I wish that my wife would go and take more risks with me and things like that. He seemed totally satisfied to just do his thing.
He sat at home. He played with chemistry. Mm-hmm. He played with electricity.
And
he
just kind of
with things. Like, he was doing stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, well, yeah, like, he was a big adventurer.
He had his hobbies. And people back in those days, I don't think were quite as romantic about marriage.
No,
as
I don't
they
think
are
so
today.
Either. Yeah. So I don't. While I'm happy to say their marriage wasn't happy and passionate, I also don't think it was unhappy. I think it was. I would describe it as an ambivalent marriage, which usually you don't kill over. Usually.
No. Well, you know,
I mean, maybe you do, but even if you do, maybe you, like, you know, chemistry, maybe you poison your wife.
Yeah, there's other ways to do it.
Instead of bludgeoning her to death. I mean.
Yeah. And, you know, definitely if he was really, truly sick of her and wanted out, then that was a way to avoid paying alimony. So that was a motive.
Yeah.
Insurance wasn't a motive. She didn't have much in the way of life insurance.
20 pounds was her life insurance policy. And he would have known that.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
So there's the argument that he made too much of a fuss over his alibi.
Over the search for the house and all that stuff.
Another factor is that phone call that he originally received at the chess club.
Oh, the message that was left for him?
Mm-hmm, yeah. So it turns out that Wallace wasn't that consistent, as we said, of a attendee to these things. Beatty did say that he came about once every 2 weeks, and Wallace said that he didn't come that often because he didn't like to leave his wife alone at night, which, okay. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, why not?
She may have been trying to think of the right word to say here. A little prone to flights of fancy in terms of paranoia, almost. She may have been
hysterics.
Thank you. She may have just been. You can't leave me alone. It's dark and scary, and I'm
what
by
if somebody
myself.
Came here? Yeah.
Yeah. Like he may have. Chess club may have been one of those few times that he could pry himself away from her at night.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, maybe she really had enemies. So, you know, hey.
From a life we didn't know about.
Exactly,
She was a government assassin.
Yeah.
The reason that his attendance of the chess club is brought up is because how would that mysterious caller have known that he was going to be there that night?
How would he have, for that matter, how would that guy have even known that he went to the chess club at all?
Yeah. How would he have known that?
Actually, well, there's a couple of easy ways to find
there
out.
There are some really
are some blatantly easy ways.
There are.
So the big claim here, to use Steve's term, is that Wallace made the call himself.
Yeah.
Right. We can do some debunking on this. First of all, Beatty described the caller's voice as strong and gruff. Pretty much opposite of Wallace's demeanor. And he didn't think that he could have made that call. He didn't think that he could have faked the voice, which I think is probably fair.
Yeah.
Also, there was a posting of the chess championships that he was taking part in.
Yep.
Yeah, who was matched to who and all that
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, and
times,
what day
dates,
they were...
Yeah.
Well, the time was the same. The time was consistent.
Yeah.
But it was what days they were showing up. And then it was actually posted on a bulletin board next to the phone booth that the phone call was received to, that had the phone number of that phone booth on it. So one could have looked at that list and gotten the phone number simultaneously.
And actually, this was not a dedicated chess club. It was no. Cottle's City Cafe.
And
a lot of different clubs met there.
And so it was a totally public space.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the persons who's been named as either a suspect or a person of interest, who we'll talk about a little later, was seen at least once at this club.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that we'll talk about that in a little bit. But, the question is, how would that person know that he would show up? Well, they had no reason to believe that he wouldn't show up. There's some discussion around the fact that he actually hadn't been there in a couple weeks, because you can see that it was recorded that he lost his first game on the first night of the championship on the sheet of paper. There's pictures of it all over. And then the next two games he missed, and then he played that night, the 19th. He didn't actually play the game he was meant to play in the championship. He played somebody else because his partner didn't show up. Again, reasons this chess club was probably disbanded is that nobody seemed to take it very seriously.
Yeah.
So while there's no reason to believe that he wouldn't show up, there's also no reason to believe that he would show up. I think that it's pretty easy to see how that person knew that he was going to show up based on where the phone call was placed from. And it was placed from a phone booth that was about 300 yards from Wallace's house. And a lot of people, again, point to, oh, well, then Wallace obviously placed the call himself. But no, because the tram that he was on, he would have had to have been on the tram about that time.
He would have had to been on at the same time, if not
the
before.
Phone was being, yeah, the, that the phone call is being placed.
Yeah, how many tram rides did it take to get to the chess club?
A couple.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
I don't remember seeing that specifically listed.
Yeah.
I just remember.
I don't know either.
The times being called out, mm-hmm. and that was it.
Yeah. So I think it would have been really easy for somebody to kind of watch him, see that he was leaving, and know probably where he was going, because it seems like that would be the place that he would be going at that time, and call
mm-hmm.
and say, oh, is he coming tonight? Oh, you don't know? Okay, well, I'm going to leave this message for him anyway, because mm-hmm. I know he's on the tram. And it actually became very important to Wallace after he was questioned by the police once and then let go. And it became really, really important to him to know what time. And he asked Beatty, okay, what time exactly?
You kind of asked him a lot, actually.
He did. And yeah. Beatty kept saying, I don't know.
That's the exact same behavior, though, that we saw him exhibiting with mm-hmm. the tram driver.
Right. And yeah. so that's the
badgering.
Thing. Is you there? There's two sides to this claim, right? Either he was trying to make sure that Beatty said, it's this time, it's definitely this time, and that he would have been able to say, well, I had to have been on the tram that time, to establish a further alibi. Or he was trying to recall, okay, around that time, where would I have been? Can I prove that I wasn't there? Oh, and also, was there anybody, did I see anybody I knew hanging around? Because if I saw somebody I knew hanging around, they placed the phone call, they were responsible for me being gone when my wife was murdered, and they were probably responsible for murdering my wife.
He's trying to figure it out.
Yeah, right. That sounds fair.
So on either side of that, I think. And Beatty said he couldn't recall what time the phone call had been placed, but it turned out that the Anfield telephone exchange somehow, by the way that the call was placed, and I don't know what that means.
Might have been through an operator.
I thought maybe through an operator, but they had it recorded and it was at exactly 7:20 p.m. So that's the time the call was placed. I think that I'm pretty sure that Wallace would have had to have been on the tram by that point, but there you go.
Yeah. It just... Everything that I've seen about the guy doesn't show me that he has it in him.
Yeah, I don't think he had the guile. I don't think he was smart enough either. And I really don't, think there was any motive, and I don't think he had the time.
Even if he didn't like his wife, I mean, beating somebody to death, I would imagine is, he didn't seem to have that kind of character.
No, he didn't. Again, he knew chemistry. Why not just poison her?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on to the theory heading. Not just the theory heading that he totally did not do it. And it's the time, right? The time is such a huge problem for me in this. Is like, where did he have the time to commit this murder?
Yeah.
Where? And clean up after himself.
Yeah, that's the whole problem. Is even if, say, the milk boy was totally off, totally wrong about the time, there's still the whole question of how he managed to do it, go somewhere and get all cleaned up and changed.
And not be seen.
And not be seen. Of course, this was like, it probably would have been pretty dark in Liverpool by, say, 6 p.m.,
at the 6:30 p.m. At the most, he had 49 minutes.
Yeah.
Because it's... somebody saw him coming home at 6:30.
Yeah.
So it's substantiated that, or at 6, sorry, that he didn't get home any earlier than 6, and he had to have left at 6:49 before, or, probably,
yeah, before
to make the tram.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, the most unaccounted time that we can give him is 49 minutes. And that's still not a lot of time.
Not really.
It's still not, and I'm not willing to say that the milk boy was wrong. I think there's every reason to believe that he knew exactly what time it was when he picked up the milk money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you saw there was a church nearby, and it wasn't visible actually from the house. But
it was about that time.
But from not far away.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
that's why there's that little, you know, it was either 6:30 or 6:45. I don't know. I just, the time is such a big problem for me.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. So I don't know why I hadn't really thought about this, and I've never actually seen this given much credence at all, but if he has such an ironclad alibi, well, maybe he did do it, but he hired it out. Like, yeah, he may have hired somebody and said, hey, I'm going to go get on the tram. Go call me. And then, okay, I'm going to my appointment. Wink, wink. Go do your job, and you'll get your 20 pounds in a couple of days when the heat dies down, because everybody's going to, you know, people do this all the time, is they get somebody killed and they expect all of the sympathy to be thrown at them, and they're the poor, sad widower now, and then it all backfires.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem...
Again,
there are claims.
I totally get that it doesn't make sense for him, because that's not the way he seemed.
But it's possible.
Yeah, there are people out there who say that he did actually hire somebody to do it.
Mm-hmm. There are people out there who said that aliens did it too. So I mean,
yeah, there are. But
Greys hated her.
They just hated her because she knew too much, I guess. I don't know.
She insulted their big eyes.
Well, and the other thing is that, like, everybody talks about this case being perfect, and they admire it because it's like this mastermind chess game. Which, okay, one of the things that Wallace liked was chess, but he was horrible at it. He was so bad at it. I probably could have beat him, and I'm like, can't play chess at all. I mean, he was okay. He won every once in a while.
I thought he was kind of mediocre rather than actually terrible.
All right. He wasn't terrible. He was a mediocre player. I gotta agree with Joe.
I'm gonna say mediocre at best. But he was not this like chess mastermind. Chess wasn't his whole life. He liked it, sure, but he liked chemistry too. He liked botany too. He liked playing with electrics too. He liked playing the violin. He was awful at the violin. He liked things he wasn't really very good at.
Yeah, no, he hadn't actually been playing the violin very long. He took that up really late in life.
Right.
Violin is a tough instrument.
For sure.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying that, like, it seems like it was a thing that he liked. And it happened that, yeah, the call was placed when he was at this chess club, but he didn't go that often.
It also appears that the media at the time really drove home the idea that he was some kind of chess mastermind.
Yeah.
Because there's spreads from the time that you can see. And they make,
oh yeah, they
look
make
at his
look...
long, spindly, pointy fingers. He obviously has a genius brain.
Yeah.
All this really weird claims that you could get away with at the time.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure the whole chess thing, it's the media's fault.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
But I just think it's interesting. And I just want to make sure everybody knows he wasn't some like mastermind chess player. He was a mediocre at best player.
Yeah, I think he was an intelligent guy.
Your smarts and your gamesmanship are two different things.
Yeah, no, you can be very smart and be a lousy chess player.
I'm very smart and I'm a terrible chess player.
Oh, you're very smart.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying today. No, I mean, yes, that's true. You don't have to be smart to be a good chess player and vice versa. But I don't see it. I don't see him as this, like, calculator. I mean, he lost his job so many times, and he kind of, like, he seemed kind of like this meek little, I want to use the term bumbling. I don't think that's right, but
no.
He just kind of seems like,
Well, you know, often criminal masterminds want you to believe that, but didn't you see The Usual Suspects?
It's true.
Yeah, that's true, except for that he would have if
Kaiser
he,
Soze?
But yeah. If he had been taking that personality on, he would have appeared that way in his trial too, right? He wouldn't have appeared detached and cold.
Yeah.
Right? Which makes me think it's more authentic. You know, all of the interactions they hear about before his wife's murder, I think he's kind of awkward and weird and, you know, again, bumbly, even though that's not the right word. And then after he sees his wife having been bludgeoned to death, he detaches and goes cold. And that seems like a normal human behavior to me, but apparently to everybody else, that seems like a criminal mastermind. So there you go.
Yeah.
So if it's not him,
then who?
Yeah.
That's the big question, right? There are a couple other suspects, actually. And one of them is a young man by the name... Well, he was young at the time, excuse me. He's dead now. He wasn't young. Yeah. His name is Richard Perry, and he was 22 years old, and he had very recently left or been fired from his job with the Prudential.
I didn't see anything that indicated that he'd been fired.
I saw a lot that indicated that he'd been sort of let go, because apparently he had a similar job as Wallace did.
Right.
He was like a junior.
Right. And I know where you're going with that, but the things that I had read all indicated that he was there for a while after everything happened, but nothing that I read indicated that he was fired. It just, he left.
Yeah.
He went to a job in a similar company.
I heard that there was a little bit of embarrassment over money not turned in, and then his parents came forward and paid basically the 30-pound difference.
Then you found something.
So he didn't get.
Okay.
Yeah, he did not get fired exactly, but he did leave the job. Mm-hmm. And
that's the clarification.
He was asked kindly to leave.
And that then there was a rumor that Wallace had played a part in that.
Yeah, there was that rumor that that Wallace knew, because he had taken over some of Wallace's account when Wallace had a bout of meningitis.
Pneumonia. I think it was bronchitis.
Bronchitis. One of those.
Meningitis is a
lot. You're right.
Yeah, I just said meningitis. No way.
Yeah.
Yeah, bronchitis, right?
I think it was bronchitis.
So Perry had been collecting, and somebody, I think, said, oh, you know, this account didn't pay in full. And Wallace thought, that's odd. I'm sure they did. And it turned out that Perry had stolen some money, and Wallace reported him or didn't report. So you can read some accounts that say, like, and Perry just didn't report him, and just, but Perry, oh no, I'm sorry, that Wallace didn't report Perry, but that Perry knew that Wallace knew, and, or I believe more that probably Wallace reported Perry, because.
He might have reported him, or he might have gone to Perry and said, hey, dude. Mm-hmm. You either cough up this money or I'm turning you in. And so that's when he went to his parents and got some money and, you know, paid it off.
And then left.
Eventually left anyway. Yeah,
because he really fancied himself as a bit of a playboy.
Mm-hmm.
But he was always broke.
Yeah.
I've got all this money.
Yeah.
Just not right now.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Speaking of Perry, he is a suspect for some people. And then there's other people who say that P.D. James, for example, the mystery writer.
Oh, we're going to talk about this.
Oh, you want to talk about that later?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
No.
Right.
Sorry.
All right.
Keep your hat on.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. There's another.
That's okay.
Did you hear anything about Joseph Caleb Marsden?
Yeah, but we'll talk about that.
We'll talk about
later
that later
too.
Okay.
So it seems that actually collection agents at the time would, you know, walk around, like Steve was saying, and collect their money, their dues, and keep them in a lockbox, often overnight at their homes, and then go in the next morning and turn all the money in.
Yeah, I think,
and that's what Wallace tended to do.
Although I don't think it was even a lockbox. I think it was more like a cigar box.
It's just a box.
Yeah.
Yeah. Perry, apparently being the jerk that he was, and he knew Julia. Because I guess Perry and Wallace had been mildly friendly, at least when Perry was doing Wallace's collections.
Yeah, because he had to stop by at the end of the day and turn the money over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the theory goes that he made the fake call in order to rob Wallace, because he thought Wallace would have all of these collections at the end of the next night. And he knocked on the door, and Julia said, oh, it's you, Mr. Perry, come in. And so he came in and bludgeoned her to death and tried to rob Mr. Wallace of all of his takings for the day. But it turned out that it was just like a couple pounds.
Yeah, it was 4 pounds, I heard.
Something like that. Yeah, some tiny, tiny amount. And so it was, you know, that sucked for him, and he left, and I don't know, never came forward, obviously.
Yeah,
obviously.
My understanding about the way it worked is, and I'm not sure exactly what the timing was, but it's like there were some people who paid like once a week, and other people paid like once a month.
Mm-hmm.
So on those days when the once a month payers are paying,
mm-hmm. there's a lot of money.
Then it's going to be a lot of money.
Right.
Yeah.
So he miscalculated.
Maybe he misfigured which day it was going to be. All these people were going to be making their monthly payment or not.
Yeah. So there's a little evidence, I guess. I don't know how reliable it is, but
I was going to say this is circumstantial to me.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
He did have a car. Perry did. And apparently a mechanic either saw a bloody glove in Perry's car or saw Perry hosing the interior of his car out with a high pressured hose while his gloves were covered in blood. Not totally sure. And then Perry's alibi, when the police questioned him, was given by his then fiance, who later jilted, redacted the statement and offered a new statement saying that Perry had not been with her that night.
Did you say redacted?
Yeah, what did I say? Retracted is what I meant.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Well. Kind of same thing.
crossed
it out.
Yeah. She took a Sharpie to
it. Same thing, yeah. So, lesson to all of you gentlemen out there, if you're in a relationship and you murder someone and your significant other is your alibi, do not jilt that person.
Stay with that person forever.
I know, seriously. I mean, Amber, haven't you guys learned your lesson?
Come on, guys. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, she said, you know, Perry asked me to provide this alibi. I have no idea where he was that night. So, yeah. I mean, you know, he had time. He had a kind of possible motive. He had a shoddy alibi. Shoddier alibi than Wallace had, to be fair. There's actually more evidence for Perry to have done this than there is Wallace.
Definitely. Well, there's not much in the way of evidence, but definitely it's possible where it doesn't appear to be really possible that Wallace could have done it.
Yeah. Yeah. So the only other thing to like add to this is there were a couple journalists at the time who were pretty convinced that Perry had done it, and they questioned him and he kept saying, no, I didn't do it. But they finally questioned him on his doorstep in 1966.
On death's doorstep?
No, on Perry's doorstep.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. In 1966, excuse me. And reportedly, he had a shockingly in-depth understanding of the case, including the fact that he knew lots of details that were, like, way unknown by the layperson, and details on lower-level witnesses, like when they died or how they died, and basically knowledge that somebody shouldn't have, necessarily. It seems that he took a very keen interest in the case.
Yeah. Although, you know, he was questioned by the police at the time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think this is that unusual because, number one, it was a very famous case.
Mm-hmm.
He was peripherally involved.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't think it's his interest
to learn as much as he can.
But to continue to learn about, like, he tracked those witnesses and knew about their lives after the case, for instance.
Maybe he was trying to solve it.
Maybe he was, yeah. So, that's the evidence for Perry. And then there's one of the things that Joe was about to talk about, and now we're going to actually talk about it, is Petey James's claim.
Yeah.
That Perry made the prank phone call, but then Wallace committed the murder anyway, and that they were totally unconnected.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she said because Perry apparently was a little angry over his the whole incident at the Prudential,
which makes sense.
Yeah, and so just for fun, he thought he'd play a mean little prank and send him on a wild goose chase. And so it might have been him, and that would explain why the phone call was made from that particular phone booth, because he's going to, like, observe him leaving for his chess club thing. Perry was the one. Perry, by the way, was involved with an acting club.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually met at the same place that the chess club did.
Yeah.
And so he would have known. He had seen him there. He'd seen Wallace at the chess club at that place before. So he would have had an idea. So it's Monday night. He sort of stakes out the place on Wilburton Street where they lived. And then sees him leaving, assumes it's for the chess club. Goes to the phone booth, makes that phone call, and leaves that message, sending him on a wild goose chase. But it was just a mean practical joke more than anything else. It wasn't.
Yeah, the whole thing about finding that street sounds so much like just a practical joke.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a snipe hunt.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then, so I read an article or two about P.D. James's claims that she had solved it and that she, you know, she knew it was Wallace that had done it. And I still don't quite get her argument.
I don't either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I really don't, actually. I think her theory about Perry making the phone call is reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as Wallace, I'm still not convinced.
Yeah, I'm not either. And then we have one more theory.
Yeah.
With Marsden, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Joseph Caleb Marsden.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had, and this again was from John Gannon's book, The Killing of Julia Wallace. And he says, he alleges that Wallace hired Joseph Caleb Marsden to do it.
Yeah.
through Richard Gordon Perry, because actually Perry knew Marsden,
mm-hmm.
And so Marsden actually did the dirty work, and that's the theory.
Yeah. Yeah, or the other theory, I also heard that Marsden did the dirty work for Perry, not for Walt. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, there's, you know, one of the things that is troubling about this case, for instance, is there are a lot of books written about this case.
Oh, yeah.
And some of the information in there is shoddy at best, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
Like, one of them says that it's unknown if Wallace won the prize for the chess championship in which he was competing, which is absurd because he played in one official, maybe two, maybe, I don't know if that one on January 19th counted or not towards the championship, but there were like seven games, eight games. He played in one and lost, played in another one and won, but it was different. Then he was in jail.
Yeah.
So he definitely didn't win. So I don't know why this book is saying, well, we don't know if he
won
or not.
Because it was a series that ran through, I think, the...
It was March.
February, yeah. March, somewhere in there, and it ended. So there's no way.
Yeah, he couldn't have. But it just goes to show you that even before the internet existed, there was bilge getting out there in the public spaces. Yeah.
Oh, actually, you know what? I just remembered while we were talking about this, that second match that he played that night, he played against a friend who was ranked like a couple ranks higher than him. So they were ineligible to play against each other in the championship.
So it didn't count.
It didn't count.
That's
he did win that game.
Recorded on that card that we see on the internet. Okay.
He won the game, but officially he only played one game in the championship and he lost, so he definitely,
and he was super proud of winning that match.
He was.
He talked,
which he should have been,
all night long with everybody about
he should have been
the final move,
because this guy was a
better,
really good chess player. Actually a really good chess player. Yeah, but I guess, you know, my final thoughts on this is I'm just gonna quote Gerald Abrams. He was a barrister who lived in Liverpool at the time. He's written a lot about the Wallace case. And he says, quote, "Journalists have agitated their readers for many years with the question, was Wallace guilty? There are three approaches to this question. One, legally, it's academic. There was no evidence against him. Two, personally, his acquaintances, excluding those who revel in the troubles of their, quote, friends, seem convinced of his innocence. The author takes the view that to vest Wallace with guilt in the circumstance is to credit him with a mental power, a skill, an agility, and a cold-blooded nerveless efficiency of which he seemed utterly incapable."
Seems fair.
Yeah. And three, scientifically, it is a much easier hypothesis to assume another person as a murderer whose task would have been easier, mental effortless. By the principle of simple explanation, Wallace was innocent, unquote.
Yeah.
I especially like him saying it's crediting Wallace with a lot of stuff that he was just not capable of, which is true.
Which most of us, frankly, are not capable of. I think he's entirely correct.
I think either that or
he's a mad genius.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
But I just don't think Wallace did it, but I don't know who did.
We said this in the very beginning, because we don't know anything about Julia. Well, I mean, really, there's very little on record that we know about her. We don't know if there was something in her past
that came back
to bite her.
The police were able to rule out neither of them had any lovers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, neither of them had any debts, really, that anybody could find. So it seemed unlikely that it was wrapped up in Julia, I guess.
Well, but
maybe it was.
The amount of anger that was in the murder.
Yeah.
Because it was effing brutal.
Mm-hmm.
It really means that somebody had a personal stake that they were taking out on her, whether it be a past jilted lover or a wrong family member, or hell, I don't know, maybe she had a kid and she gave that kid up and that kid tracked her down all these years later and said, you made me an orphan, I'm going to take it out on you. I mean, I don't know what it is. There could be a bajillion things, or there could truly still be nothing.
Yeah.
It could actually be somebody who didn't even know her and just a serial killer who just wanted
just
to murder somebody.
Or just some weirdo who needed money and knew he had money.
Yeah.
Again, maybe this is where Perry comes into, you know, he knows this guy who's a real scuzzbag and says, hey, I know these people aren't going to be home and I know he keeps a buttload of money in a cigar box.
Yeah, although then you run into the... There, as far as I can tell, there was no sign of a struggle. Yeah. I've never seen anything that there was a sign of a struggle. And she let the person in.
Yeah.
So you assume that she knew them and that it started out totally peacefully, or at least mildly comfortable, and they surprised her with the hit over the head.
Yeah. And that leads to our last theory. And this has actually been put out there, which is that it was the Johnstons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which,
or at least one
been.
Of the Johnstons.
I mean, it could have been.
Yeah.
Really, realistically, it could have been.
They had a key.
They had a key.
Yeah.
She knew them.
Yep.
They could have said, we're just going to come around for, you
know,
they
would have
something.
Known about the money.
She could have been cheating with the Johnstons. I mean, really.
Yeah. Who knows?
Cheating with one of them, cheating with both of them.
Oh,
it's possible.
Yeah, really. I don't know if I'd want to cheat with Julia myself.
I don't know if I would yeah. either, but hey, some people are into stuff like that. So
yeah.
Anyway. Steve, do you have any final thoughts?
I don't. This one just, it's baffling.
Yeah.
It's baffling because of the amount of bilge, as Joe put it,
yeah.
that's out there.
Yeah.
And the total lack of evidence for anything other than the fact that the only thing that we can confirm is that she died most likely by being beaten to death with the fire poker. That's really the only thing I got.
I'm pretty confident that she died by being beaten.
Yeah.
But that's really the only solid fact we have in this entire case.
Yeah, no, yeah. So somebody beat her to death and left with the poker.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what it is.
And the poker was never found.
Never.
I mean, so again,
it went down a drain.
I guess,
it went,
yeah,
yeah, it went into the river. Yeah. But
okay.
I cool. Yeah, other than that, I can't say.
Yeah.
It's it's entirely possible too that somebody set Wallace up.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
They made the phone call to the chess club deliberately from a phone booth near his house to cast suspicion upon him.
Yeah, it's totally possible. Although it doesn't seem like he had any really enemies. I mean, other than Perry.
Yeah.
I mean,
it could have been somebody trying to commit the perfect crime.
Yeah, could
just,
have been.
Just a hobby sort of thing. You know? So here's what we're going to do.
It was Sherlock Holmes, I'm pretty
sure. Yeah, it could have been. Yeah.
Was Conan Doyle in the area
at
the time?
Yeah, I know.
So but, yeah, there you have it.
Yeah, but anyway, but think about that. I mean, so he makes the phone call, knowing that that's, you know, it's going to be recorded. It's going to cast suspicion upon him that he made the call himself, not realizing that Wallace is going to go out there and he's going to, like, totally badger everybody he sees along the way. Not realizing that. In other
thinking
words,
he's going to end up with no alibi.
Yeah.
Thinking that, yeah, he thought, yeah, he was going to disappear. He murders the wife. He's going to come back with no alibi. He's going to go off to the pokey. And instead, he comes back with a great alibi.
That's true. Yeah,
yeah.
It's possible. This was a listener suggestion.
Oh, that's right.
I'll say at the end instead of the beginning.
Because we totally forgot.
I totally forgot, yeah. Mike B. Suggested it in, like, September of 2014.
Yep.
It's been a while.
It's been a while, yeah.
And
yeah.
Then,
thanks, Mike B.
The Artful Dodger on Reddit also suggested it recently. And I think we've had a couple other people.
There's been a couple
it.
Over time.
Yeah. So thank you guys. If you want to suggest a topic for us, you can do that on our website in the about the show. It's probably not the best place to do it, but you can.
Well, that's where everybody goes to
it's
do it.
Where a lot of
I don't know
go.
Why, but that's where they go.
There, yeah. That website is thinkingsidewayspodcast.com. You can also stream us there. Leave a comment about the show. You can find our links to the PayPal, to the Patreon, and to merch. You are probably listening to us on iTunes. If you are, leave a comment and a rating. Those are helpful to us. If you have serious feedback for us, we prefer an email so we can, like, talk to you about it and, like, understand what you're saying. So that email address is thinkingsidewayspodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Reddit.
You can find us just about anywhere.
Pretty much anywhere, yeah. We're not on Snapchat.
No.
We're not on Instagram.
No.
We're not on Pinterest.
No.
That's a good point.
We're not on Tinder.
Tinder or Grindr.
Well, are we on Ashley Madison?
No. No. I don't think so. I'm not.
We should check. Some people are on there and don't even know.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Where are all these weird emails coming from?
Yeah.
The note on Twitter is we're thinking sideways, not thinking sideways. And the note on Facebook is the group and the page, not friend us, don't friend us. we don't want to be friends with you. I mean,
we do.
We love you, but
don't do that.
Just join the group. Yeah. That's even better than being our friend.
Yeah, it is. And then you can get to the Patreon if you feel like you want to make a monetary donation to the show. You can do that from the website, or you can just go to patreon.com/thinkingsideways. It's where you make a sustaining donation per episode, and we super duper appreciate that because you guys have been really awesome, and we'd like to keep that momentum going so we can actually pay for the show.
Yeah.
Entirely instead of us paying for the show.
Yeah, we prefer that. We'd like to break even.
Yeah, breaking even is our goal.
My credit card loves it.
Oh, no. No. I know.
Hopefully you're getting fire miles out of it or something like that.
Yeah. Anyway, all of that having been said, I think we're going to get on out of here.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah, folks. Bye-bye.
Later, guys.
I guess we'll hear them next week. We won't see them.
Yeah, well, they'll hear us.
Yeah, that's true.